The world and everything in it is supported today by ChristianBook.com, your online resource for everything Christian. On the web at ChristianBook.com.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 12, 2016, and this is The World and Everything in It from member-supported World Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Joseph Slive. Ahead on our Monday legal docket, an American oil company takes the government of Venezuela to court. Plus, Emily Witten continues her series, The 12 Days of Books for Christmas, today with gift ideas for guys.
Daniel Silva's novel, The Black Widow, has terrific characterization and some worthwhile commentary on U.S. politics, including ISIS and the Middle East.
Up first, Kent Covington has a summary of today's top news stories.
Panic at Cairo's largest Coptic Christian cathedral. The scene just minutes after a bomb blast killed at least 25 worshipers and wounded dozens more. The blast occurred in a chapel next to the cathedral building where the faithful were attending Sunday Mass. Egyptian authorities suspect a group linked to the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood could be behind the attack. Meanwhile, Turkey is reeling from a pair of deadly explosions over the weekend. World Radio's Jim Henry has more.
The twin blasts Saturday night near a soccer stadium in Istanbul appear to have targeted police. 30 of the 38 people killed by the explosions were police officers, and another 150 people were injured. On Sunday, the Turkish government declared a day of national mourning for the fallen officers and vowed revenge against the perpetrators. ISIS and Kurdish rebels have carried out a number of attacks in Turkey in the last year, and a Kurdish separatist group has claimed responsibility for the weekend bombings. I'm Jim Henry.
President-elect Donald Trump is expected to announce his pick for Secretary of State this week, and multiple sources report that the leading candidate is ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson. Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway tells Fox News that picking Tillerson would be in keeping with Trump's promise to employ the world's best negotiators in his cabinet.
I think in the case of Mr. Tillerson, you see someone who is not a typical politician or even a diplomat. You see a successful businessman, not unlike Donald Trump, who is accustomed to negotiating.
Trump on Sunday stopped short of confirming recent reports that he's already made up his mind on who his top diplomat will be. But he, too, had good things to say about Tillerson, noting that he's done business deals with some of the world's top leaders.
To me, a great advantage is he knows many of the players, and he knows them well.
Trump also responded yesterday to the CIA's assertion that Russian hackers tried to influence last month's general election. He told Fox News Sunday host Chris Wallace,
"Hacking is very interesting. Once they hack, if you don't catch them in the act, you're not going to catch them. They have no idea if it's Russia or China or somebody. It could be somebody sitting in a bed someplace. I mean, they have no idea.
So why would the CIA put out the story that the Russians wanted you to win?
Well, I'm not sure they put it out. I think the Democrats are putting it out because they suffered one of the greatest defeats in the history of politics in this country.
President Obama is expected to sign a sweeping health bill approved last week by the Senate. Sarah Wadle reports.
The Senate passed the bipartisan 21st Century Cures Act overwhelmingly, 94-5. Among other things, the bill is aimed at speeding up the time it takes the Food and Drug Administration to approve new medicines, funding the fight against opioid abuse, expanding access to mental health treatment, and providing additional research dollars. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
This legislation promotes critical investments in research and treatment development. It helps cut through unnecessary regulations that would hinder the development of cures while also protecting safety.
Critics of the legislation, including Democratic Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, say it gives massive handouts to the pharmaceutical industry and will lower standards for government approval of drugs and medical devices. President Obama has spoken in support of the bill and says he will sign it into law. I'm Sarah Wadle.
For the first time in two decades, the life expectancy of American citizens is on the decline. That, according to a report from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC says a 10% decline in life expectancy recorded in 2015 is the first such decline since the early 1990s. At least part of the reason for the decline was a rise in preventable causes of death, such as drug overdoses and alcohol poisoning. Deaths from auto accidents were also up last year. The most common causes of death did not change much in 2015 from the year before, with heart disease claiming the most lives, followed by cancer and lower respiratory disease. There was some good news, however. Cancer-related deaths dropped by almost 2%. At the weekend box office, Moana looks to be Disney's latest animated box office juggernaut.
For generations, this peaceful island has been home to our family. But beyond our reef, a great danger is coming.
Moana sold the most movie tickets in America for the third weekend in a row, grossing another $19 million to bring its total to nearly $150 million. The R-rated comedy Office Christmas Party debuted in second place with $18 million, followed by Fantastic Beasts, Arrival, and Doctor Strange. You can find World's reviews of current films along with ratings and content information at wng.org/movies. I'm Kent Covington. Straight ahead, ancient doctrines in modern courts put to the test. That's next on The Legal Docket. Plus, day 8 of our series, 12 Days of Books for Christmas. You're listening to The World and Everything in It.
If you're a Christian parent or grandparent and you're looking for a Christmas gift that can make a real difference this year, then pay close attention to this important message. It's now possible to give a fun and entertaining gift that teaches character and Christian values to kids. These award-winning audio adventures unlock your child's natural ability to learn faster, increase attention span, even get better grades. Go to FamilyAudioAdventures.com. That's FamilyAudioAdventures.com. Use coupon code 34 and get half off. FamilyAudioAdventures.com.
Good morning. You're listening to The World and Everything in It from member-supported World Radio. It is Monday, December the 12th. I'm Nick Eicher. The U.S. Supreme Court is on break until after the holidays. We will use the next several weeks to catch you up on oral arguments completed thus far, before new cases resume in January. Today, two cases, the first one from Venezuela. This is a country that sits atop the world's largest proven oil reserves. Yet its economy is so distressed that Venezuela's largest currency note, its 100 Bolivar bill, was selling 1 week ago on the black market for 2 United States pennies. It makes more sense in Venezuela for shopkeepers to weigh the bills in order to save the time they would spend counting them. A stack of 100 of the notes is about 110 grams. Petroleum exports provide about half of Venezuela's GDP, so the volatility of global oil prices coincides roughly with the volatility of Venezuela's economy. But that's only part of it. Making matters so much worse for average Venezuelans is a hardcore socialist government in the capital, Caracas. Its policies have resulted in shortages of basic foods like milk, sugar, and flour. It is so difficult to obtain things like toilet paper and soap that some hotels in Venezuela require guests to bring their own. It is this sort of socialist economy and its reliance on petroleum that provides the backdrop for today's first case. Between now and the end of June, the U.S. Supreme Court will try to resolve a dispute between Venezuela's government and an oil drilling company based in Oklahoma. That company is Helmerich & Payne International Drilling Company. It operated in Venezuela for more than 3 decades, beginning in the 1970s. Even though Venezuela had nationalized the oil industry back then, the American company and the socialist government got along just fine. Helmerich & Payne operated through a Venezuelan subsidiary and happily provided drilling rigs to the single state-owned oil company. Happily, that is, until about 6 years ago. Between 2007 and 2010, that state-owned company managed to rack up $100 million U.S. dollars in debt to Helmerich, and the American company had had enough. So Helmerich pulled up stakes and began efforts to bring its equipment back home. And that's where the dispute arises. When the company tried to leave, the government nationalized what the company was trying to take. Then President Hugo Chavez called out the National Guard to protect the oil drilling rigs he'd seized. Venezuelan workers, who are state employees after all, physically blockaded Helmerich's two plants, as did National Guard soldiers armed with weapons. To this day, 11 of Helmerich's oil rigs remain in Venezuela, so Helmerich went to court in the United States to seek the rigs' return. Here now to analyze the arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court is World Radio legal affairs correspondent Mary Reichert.
Both sides in this case pointed to the same law to prove a different point. Venezuela and Helmerich both argued the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act vindicated their legal theories. Venezuela says the law protects foreign nations from being sued in U.S. courts. The law does have exceptions, though, and one of them is when a government seizes private property. That is the core of Helmerich's argument, that the state nationalized its oil rigs. Venezuela counters that the exception does not come into play here because the oil rigs are not private property. The rigs really do not belong to Helmerich. Arguing for Venezuela was lawyer Catherine Stetson. She, along with the Obama administration, took the position that not only was the law on Venezuela's side, but just about everything else was, too. Listen to this exchange with a perturbed-sounding Justice Samuel Alito.
We're already, for the most part, past the point where we are hewing too closely to the text. We look at the dictates of reason and coherence and judicial policy.
Well, this is a curious argument for you to be raising, because your lead argument is that the text indisputably supports your position, is it not?
Our lead argument certainly depends on the text, but my point is the text is not our only.
You just said we shouldn't pay that much attention to what the text says.
Our text is not our only anchor, is my point.
Department of Justice lawyer Elaine Goldenberg argued that ruling against Venezuela would hurt U.S. foreign relations.
And there actually have been real problems, real sensitivities, real foreign relations concerns that have been raised in this area.
But oil rig company lawyer Catherine Carroll pointed to the wishes of Congress and why it wrote the law in the first place.
Under our view of this statute, Congress and the executive were reacting to a very specific set of problems, and they adopted a very specific solution. They were looking at the Cuban expropriations and other notorious expropriations of property that were affecting U.S. interests, where sovereigns were using those expropriations to gain an unfair advantage in the commercial marketplace, and they wrote a statute that said, we want the courthouse doors to be open to those kinds of claims, a claim of a taking in violation of international law, the gravamen of which is an assertion that the defendant violated international law or the defendant's title is no good because the property was taken in violation of international law. All those are within the scope.
Chief Justice John Roberts tacked in the other direction. What if the matter in dispute is frivolous or a small amount of money? Wouldn't that be rather silly to make an international incident out of it?
Our ambassadors have to go to these other countries and say, or their ambassadors, you're being sued. You have to come into our courts, even though you're a sovereign, and we don't want you dragging us into your courts. But you have to come in our courts because someone has raised a claim that is not wholly insubstantial or frivolous. That's a very low standard in that context.
Carroll pointed back to the larger matter of jurisdiction as the first concern of the court, not the amounts involved. Justice Stephen Breyer said as much to Goldenberg, Venezuela's lawyer.
I'm getting pushed the other way. I came in on your side.
Oh, dear. Well,
I swing back and forth. But this is what's really bothering me. It sounds, the more I hear you speak, that there isn't a good thing that we're going to write in this case. It isn't going to get everybody good and mixed up, because it reminds me of a case where we set a kind of order of battle. As first you have to decide the jurisdiction, and then you decide this and that.
Nobody wants to make it too easy for other nations to sue the U.S. in their courts, so avoiding retaliation seemed important to the justices. But as the lower court in this case ruled, not only is Helmerich's property involved, the interests of shareholders in that company count as well. It's that basis on which the lower court held Helmerich ought to be able to proceed with its lawsuit. This is a fuzzy area of the law, so it's anybody's guess how the court will rule. My second case today involves competitors fighting over products for adult incontinence. One company designed a product for which it earned a patent. It says another company stole. The patent holder is SCA Hygiene. The alleged patent thief is a company called First Quality. First Quality says it owes SCA Hygiene no damages because of an ancient legal theory called laches, L-A-C-H-E-S. It means unreasonable delay in making a claim or filing a lawsuit. Now, this is a theory, by the way, that I use at home. On those rare occasions my husband brings up something rotten I did in the past, I cite latches, and it goes like this. Latches, my dear, I may have done that bad thing you say I did, but it's too late to bring it up now. Do take note, it really doesn't work in that context. In the law, though, it frequently does work. Latches as a defense against wrongdoing goes back centuries to Middle Ages England. It's similar to a statute of limitations, time limits during which you must sue or lose the right to sue, but it's also different because latches looks at how reasonable a delay is, looks at the facts of a particular case, and gives individual judges discretion to do what's right and fair under the circumstances. Patent holder SCA Hygiene's argument is that it's unfair to let patent infringers claim latches while profiting from stolen ideas. Bad policy, bad faith. Lawyer Martin Black seemed to have the justice's sympathies with this opening statement.
Injecting judicial discretion into the statutory scheme would frustrate the will of Congress and create uncertainty about something as fundamental as the timeliness of suit.
SCA Hygiene filed its patent infringement claim within the 6 years required by law. So, Black argued, end of case. Let's not muddy the waters with ancient doctrines. Besides that, the Supreme Court just 3 terms ago decided that latches couldn't be used to ward off a copyright infringement lawsuit. Even Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said patents are not much different from copyright. That meant First Quality's lawyer, Seth Waxman, faced an uphill battle. Justice Elena Kagan lobbed a direct question at Waxman.
Mr. Waxman, wouldn't we expect that if Congress wanted to make an exception for patent law or wanted to continue the exception that existed as a result of the pre-existing practice, that Congress actually would have said so?
The familiar congressional intent argument. But Waxman valiantly defended history's use of latches.
And we think that there is a literal mountain of cases. Every single case has recognized that latches was a defense in an appropriate case to claims for damages. And no case has ever said or suggested to the contrary. And so therefore,
Chief Justice John Roberts pushed back on that. Courts of law are different from the courts of equity that Waxman references. Equity courts decided disputes where money was not the issue.
Well, that's where your mountain becomes a molehill, right? I mean, the cases in which latches was applied at law were insignificant, certainly not enough to support a consensus that Congress...
Justice Stephen Breyer seemed the most conflicted. In the recent Supreme Court ruling throwing out latches in copyright cases, he dissented. Here he is addressing Lawyer Black, for the patent holder, referencing that case.
What's going to happen after about 30 years where the plaintiff has just laid in wait to see if the material is a success? After they spend all the money, it's a success, and he sues for the last 6 years and collects all the profit while the defendant was the one who paid all the money that earned the profit. Never fear, said the majority. Because you can deduct all that expense from the 6 years' profit that you're suing for. Never fear. And I didn't really overcome that argument very well. But in this case, it isn't true that you can deduct. And therefore, plaintiffs can lie in wait to see. And it is 40 times more difficult for a company that has relied on their not suing to change the hundreds of billions of dollars in investment. And in case we think that's theoretical, Dell has filed a brief involving Sprint, Lucent, and other companies where they spent close to billions knowing there was somebody out there who might sue, but he wasn't going to. He led them to believe he wasn't, approximately. And then later on, they come back and they try to get all this money, just the profit, without the deduction of the loss when it's too late for the company to change. Now, I'll look into that, but that, in my mind, is a big difference.
So you see the push and pull of parallel legal theories, statutes, history, precedent, and practicality. I think the court will strive for consistency and clarity, I predict it will align patent law with copyright law and throw out the latches defense infringers use to thwart cases against them. And that is saying a lot, because it absolutely goes against literally hundreds of years of precedent. Both sides have very strong arguments here. On the Legal Docket for World Radio, I'm Mary Reichard.
In case you didn't know, The World and Everything in It is a member-supported program of World News Group. World relies on our members, many of whom give tax-deductible contributions to help fund the honest journalism we work hard to provide. This is Kevin Martin, CEO of World News Group. Here we are at the end of a year in which our members enabled us to deliver The World and Everything in It on a daily basis, and we are profoundly grateful for the opportunity to serve you through this program.
You're listening to The World and Everything in It from World Radio, and now news about business, the markets, and the economy on the Monday Money Beat. The closing bell Friday at the New York Stock Exchange as traders cheered all-time highs for both the Dow Industrials and the S&P 500. Both indexes were up a little more than 3% for the week. Since Election Day, the Dow has set record highs 14 times, while the S&P 500 has risen to new highs 7 times. The NASDAQ Composite was up more than 3.5% for the week. It, too, closed Friday at a record high. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve reported that U.S. household net worth also set a record, climbing to more than $90 trillion in the third quarter. The big drivers are this year's strong stock market and increases in real estate values. The report also showed that balances in savings accounts have risen, at least in the aggregate. But consider all that good news in relation to this. A new report from several university-level economists and sociologists has found that barely half of 30-year-olds are earning more than their parents did at a similar age when the numbers are adjusted for inflation. That is a strong reversal from the 1970s, when well over 90% of 30-year-olds were outpacing what their parents had earned at that point in their lives. The most downwardly mobile states in the country are Michigan, Vermont, Nevada, Washington State, and Alaska. On the financial calendar this week, earnings reports from Pier 1, Adobe, and Oracle. And on Wednesday, if the conventional wisdom proves correct, the Fed will raise short-term interest rates by a quarter of a point, the first such increase since last December. We'll wait and see. And that's today's Money Beat. Now to day 8 of our series, 12 Days of Books for Christmas, with reviewer Emily Witten. We're bringing you 12 segments during this Advent season with suggestions of books that would make for good gifts this Christmas. Good Monday morning, Emily.
Good morning, Joseph.
Okay, now up to this point, we've been talking mostly about books for children and teenagers. Today we're going to move to books for adults, men in particular. What caught your eye this year for them?
Our editor-in-chief, Marvin Alasky, apparently often reads while walking on his treadmill. Yep. And one of the most amusing reviews I read in World this year was one in which Marvin used his treadmill pace and distance to prove the excellence of Daniel Silva's new novel, The Black Widow. Marvin wrote that he registered 31,000 steps in one day as measured by Fitbit.
Wow.
That's over 14 miles. And that frenzied walking made the book for him the year's most gripping novel. So he says the book has terrific characterization, powerful narrative, and some worthwhile commentary on U.S. politics, including ISIS and the Middle East. Some readers may want to note that the book includes violence brought on by suicide bombers, and characters do use expletives 5 times in 500 pages. But if your guy can handle that and a suspenseful story and potentially a lot of treadmill walking, this might be a good choice.
But you might want to include a good pair of walking shoes with that one.
Exactly.
Okay, well, how about something a little less heart-pounding for our nonfiction fans?
Our listeners with sports fans on their list may want to pick up For the Glory, Eric Liddell's Journey from Olympic Champion to Modern Martyr by Duncan Hamilton. It's an eye-opening biography of the hero of the old Chariots of Fire movie, but rather than stopping at the point when Liddell wins Olympic gold, as the movie does, the author here follows Liddell on his missionary journeys to China, where he actually died as a Japanese prisoner of war. And if you want a sketch of a Christian athlete who lives life well despite very painful circumstances, For the Glory is your book.
And some listeners may remember that you recommended that book earlier this year in our summer reading series.
Right.
Now, I believe you want to talk about one more book that you mentioned during the summer series as well.
I do. Street God by Dima Salaberius might be the book that left my mouth hanging open most often this year. As a pastor of a New York City church with connections to Tim Keller, Salaberius might seem to be a fairly normal, traditional kind of pastor. But his biography contains so many brushes with death, so many twists and turns, it's hard to believe that he even survived to adulthood. Into the darkness surrounding his early life as a drug dealer, God's hand unmistakably reaches in and just turns his life upside down, so that by the end of the book, Salaberius becomes an extraordinary leader for Christ, even organizing religious freedom marches across the Brooklyn Bridge. I did note in my earlier reviews that some of the drug dealing, violence, and occult content here means the book is best suited to older teens and adults.
All right. Well, we have time for one final book idea for adult men.
Well, back to the theme of walking and running, one other book Marvin Alasky recommended in World Magazine might be worth mentioning here. Marvin wrote back in April of the book titled A Resilient Life, You Can Move Ahead No Matter What. And let me just read a little bit of what Marvin said about it. He said, quote, "We need reminders that life is a distance race, not a dash. In this book, Denver Seminary Chancellor Gordon MacDonald writes about how lessons learned from his prep school track coach, Marvin Goldberg, have stayed with him through a lifetime," unquote. So in the book, MacDonald lays out these life lessons he learned from his coach. And if you know a sports-oriented guy, especially one who might need some encouragement right now, MacDonald's time-tested book on resilience might be greatly appreciated.
Sounds very interesting. Emily, thanks for all the recommendations today.
You're welcome, Joseph.
Now, to recap, these are the titles she recommended today for men. First, Daniel Silva's novel, The Black Widow. For the Glory by Duncan Hamilton, that's the one about Olympic gold medalist Eric Liddell. Street God, the autobiography of Dima Salaberios. And finally, A Resilient Life by Gordon MacDonald. Emily will post all those titles and authors today on her Twitter feed in case you missed any of them. You can find that information on Twitter using hashtag TWE12DaysOfBooks. Hashtag TWE12DaysOfBooks. Now, we've also had several listeners ask if we could post Emily's 12 days list at WNG.org, so we're going to do that later today. And I'll have that specific address for you on Wednesday when we present day 9 of our series, 12 Days of Books for Christmas.
Salt brings out the flavor. And when it comes to reporting the news, World tries to be salt, not sugar. You see, we're not here to be sticky sweet, but to stand for factual accuracy and biblical objectivity. Because we believe in a God who tells the truth and wants us to do the same. We're tough-minded but warm-hearted when presenting the news that matters to you. Going beyond the breaking news of the day to talk about culture, history, religion, and technology. World, bringing out all the flavors of God's world.
Next, to our time machine, as it were, as we explore some of what's happened during this week in history. Here with the World Radio History Book, Paul Butler.
Today we begin with December 13, 1545, and the opening of the first session of the Council of Trent. The Ecumenical Council is called by Pope Paul III and will meet 25 times over the next 18 years, confirming essential Catholic doctrines and condemning what it identifies as Protestant heresies.
It was, of course, in response to the Protestant Reformation. How to respond to the criticisms of Luther, Calvin, and the other reformers.
Catholic theologian Bishop Robert Barron says Trent proved to be more divisive than it should have been.
One of the tragedies is, frankly, that it took so long to come together. If the Council of Trent had happened, let's say, in 1525, would that have made more of a difference? If Luther, let's say, had been at the Council of Trent, would that have made a difference?
In the years leading up to the Council of Trent, French reformer John Calvin had been calling for a church council to address many of the excesses and abuses that had crept into the church. In 1547, Calvin published a critical tract titled Acts of the Council of Trent with the antidote.
It is established in the prefatory address, he says, that this pompous council is held not for inquiry, but to give official sanction to the errors and superstition that have crept into the church.
Theologian Michael Horton of Westminster Seminary, California.
The reformers have no controversy with the true Catholic Church, Calvin contended in his letter to Cardinal Sadoleto. We are only trying to renew that ancient form of the church that has been distorted by illiterate men and was afterwards mangled and almost destroyed by the Roman pontiff and his faction.
Protestant representatives were present at many of the meetings of the Trent Council. But by 1562, it was clear that all hope of reconciling with the Protestant faction was gone. The council concluded in 1563 with a series of acclamations honoring the popes, the emperor, and kings who had supported it, followed by acclamations of anathema, or curses pronounced against those considered to be heretics. Next, December 12, 2000.
Good evening, everybody. I'll make it quick and simple to beginning. The Supreme Court of the United States has reversed the decision of the Florida Supreme Court. Let me go to George Stephanopoulos very quickly here because, George, this effectively ends the election.
It has ended the election. And, Peter, literally one of the closest elections in American history.
The U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, rules that the recount ordered by the Florida Supreme Court is unconstitutional. Their decision brings an end to the month-long legal battle over the results of the 2000 election. Texas Governor George Bush is awarded 271 electoral votes and becomes the president-elect. The next day, U.S. Vice President Al Gore concedes during a speech delivered from the old executive building next door to the White House.
Just moments ago, I spoke with George W. Bush and congratulated him on becoming the 43rd president of the United States. Now the political struggle is over, and we turn again to the unending struggle for the common good of all Americans and for those multitudes around the world who look to us for leadership in the cause of freedom. Thank you, and good night, and God bless America.
And finally, the morning of December 14th, 2003. Americans awake to the news that former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein has been captured alive. Paul Bremer is the administrator of the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
The military action, codenamed Operation Red Dawn, includes 600 soldiers and special forces. Hussein is discovered in a 6-foot-deep spider hole near the town of Adwar in central Iraq. He emerges without resistance, saying, "I am Saddam Hussein, president of Iraq, and I want to negotiate." Later, an Iraqi special tribunal finds the former dictator guilty of war crimes and genocide. He is executed in December 2006. That's this week's look into the World Radio History Book. I'm Paul Butler.
We're so glad you could be with us today. That just about wraps up the program for this Monday. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio, which is made possible by our world members. Tell your friends about our complimentary 3-month trial membership. It'll give them full access to this program, along with World Digital and World Magazine, all at no charge and with no obligation for 3 full months. Just point them to getworldnow.com. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Joseph Slive. On tomorrow's program, remembering a man who put the Christian church in touch with its past, theologian, author, and editor Thomas Oden. He died last week at age 85. We hope you can join us for The World and Everything In It.